This is The Think Tank with Dr. Mike O'Neill, talking about the major political, economic, and social issues of the week. KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com. The Think Tank.
Okay, most exciting guest today. He's been a guest before, but he has a new product. Marty Latz is the negotiator, and he has written a new book called The Real Trump Deal, an eye-opening look at how he really negotiates. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me back, Mike.
We're going to get into the whole business of what we know about how Donald Trump negotiates, but I thought for context, we might take you back in terms of your intellectual history and the Harvard negotiation product, of which I know it goes back in your education, because that differs from what most people think of as negotiate. I think what Donald Trump postures himself as and negotiate is what most lay people think of it. Negotiation is, I'm hard-nosed, I'm going to, you know, make unreasonable demands and force my will on you. That is a style of negotiation.
That's right, Mike. That
but
is
it's not the only one. And the Harvard negotiation product was a famous an alternative to that. And I wonder if you could talk about that a little bit so we could then set that in contrast to what we know about Donald Trump's negotiating style.
Sure, Mike. In fact, the brilliance really of my professor in law school, Roger Fisher, and his colleague Bill Urey, who came out with Getting to Yes in 1981, was that they suggested that there are different ways of negotiating in different factual contexts. Yes, of course, traditionally we've got the hard nose, zero sum, win lose, super aggressive, super tough sounding
negotiator. And in fairness, that's a style that under some circumstances works.
That's exactly right. In fact, you should use that style and those strategies in certain contexts. But what Fisher and Urey really generated was an understanding that that's not the only way. In fact, that is counterproductive in other contexts, especially where the parties anticipate and want a future relationship. So instead of being super competitive, super adversarial, if I'm negotiating with a partner and we're going to be working together on a long-term basis, that's not the strategy you want to use, because then it ends up being a true lose-lose. So even though the term win-win has become popularized today to describe almost every deal, what it really means is that the way in which we engage by sharing information, by trusting each other, but still verifying, of course, as Ronald Reagan used to say, that will lead to an expanded and a bigger pie, and we're going to be better off in all circumstances if we use that alternative style versus the bulldog, I got to win at all cost mentality.
And let me set out a case where I think win-lose makes sense. I'm buying a car. I'm buying a car with the following attributes. This is exactly the car I want, and the only issue is how much am I going to pay? And furthermore, I'm probably never going to have another relationship with the car dealer again ever.
Well, that's right.
So if I pay every $100 more I pay is money out of my pocket and in theirs.
It's zero sum. $1 more for you is $1 less for them, and it's a commodity. So, you know, it doesn't really matter who you buy it from. The quality is going to be the same. The service is going
to
be the same.
There's nothing else to talk about.
It's only price. And that's where zero sum competitive. I'm selling a building. You're buying a building. I'm retiring. I'm moving to Hawaii. I'm never going to see you again. I'm never going to see anyone that you know again. And I really don't care about maybe sometimes my reputation so much. In contrast to a situation where we're working together, there are multiple issues on the table. And by sharing information, we may find some mutual interest that we didn't even realize when we first had our conversation.
And I think of two extreme examples of that. At the personal level, the extreme example is the family, where the relationship is almost always more important than whatever it is that you're talking about. And the other thing in the political sphere is international relations. We have allies. We have international trading partners. We have people with whom we may be cutting some deal right now, but whom we have a continuing relationship, and not just over trade, but over mutual defense over a myriad of other things.
And Mike, what the really important part of what you just said relates to the relationship. The relationship in a family negotiation is more important than any dollars that are going to be traded or back and forth when you're dealing with your kids, when you're dealing with your spouse, when you're dealing with your in-laws. The dollars aren't nearly as important as the relationship and the fact that you're going to be seeing them and communicating with them and negotiating with them. In a sense, if you think about it broadly, anytime two people are interacting with each other and they have interests to satisfy, they're negotiating. And likewise, as you said, in the international context and even in the national context in dealing with members of Congress, you're going to be seeing them again, multiple issues, multiple parties.
I want your vote today, but I'd also like your consideration tomorrow and
That's exactly right. Mm-hmm. We're going to see each other, and so I can't burn my bridges. I need to deal with you in a way that takes into account the fact that I've got to go to Mitch McConnell, not just on this tax legislation, but I've got to go to him on the government shutdown legislation. I've got to go to him on environmental legislation. So if I burn my bridges early on in a one-shot deal, I'm going to have problems in the future.
You know, I just thought of where it's an even more extreme political example of that. It's not in the legislature. It's in the Supreme Court. There's only 8 other justices. The average tenure is over 20 years. Now you're going to be in the same room with these people 5 days a week, 9 months a year for the next 10 plus years.
The internal Supreme Court and mm-hmm. other judicial negotiations are really crucial because you can disagree sometimes intellectually, but you have to do it in a way that takes into account the fact that you're going to be running into them in the hallways mm-hmm. for years.
Mm-hmm. And famously, you know, Ruth Bader Ginsburg was best buddies with Scalia, polar opposites ideologically, but I suspect it had a lot of positive benefits for both of them professionally.
Oh, I think
to be able to cross that divide.
I think that's exactly right, Mike.
So one other thing, and this is just to kind of wrap the bow on this context. I wonder if you would describe the difference between positions and interests, because I think it was the key to the whole getting to yes Harvard negotiation project.
Well, that's right, Mike. And a position is what you want. I want the car at the lowest price. I want to have our partnership go in this direction. I want this share of the income from our partnership. Position is what you want. The interest is why you want it. What's the motivation? What's the driver? Sometimes I think about it as the hidden agenda in the negotiation. So if you've ever dealt with someone who has an ego, just to pick a random thought, since we're talking about my new book, The Real Trump Deal, an ego they want to feel. Not only do they need to get as much money as they can, but they need to feel like they won. They need to feel like they achieved success. And that is a driver that's coming from them from an internal perspective.
When I'm buying a car, I don't want to feel like I was a sucker.
Well, that's right. That's a driver.
So you talk to people, even if they didn't get the best deal, they all think they did, or they think they got close enough that it's okay.
And that has a value. That has mm-hmm. a value in the negotiation that in part drives some of what I call offer concession strategy. Mm-hmm. So I may be a little bit more aggressive early on just so I can concede so you feel like you got a good deal.
You know, I think of, again, interest in positions. I want to build a wall on our southern border. That's a position. It's really not the interest.
No.
On this side, the interest is we would like to have a secure border that is controlled by our country.
And
the wall is at best a means to an end.
And there are other interests as well. So there are safety issues. Mm-hmm. There are security issues. There are economic issues. These are all interests that are driving the position of building the wall. We have financial interests, right? I mean, the second part of then-candidate Trump's infamous promise is not only are we going to build the wall, but we're going to make Mexico pay for it. Mm-hmm. So we had an economic and a financial interest in doing that.
Well, we'll be back with Marty Latz. We're going to move from this theoretical discussion, and we're going to talk about what we know about Donald Trump's negotiating style by examining series of his early business dealings that set the context. And then later on in the segment after that, we'll talk about as president when we return in just a moment in the Think Tank.
The Think Tank, KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
We're back with Marty Latz discussing his new book, The Real Trump Deal, an eye-opening look at how he really negotiates. And I will offer, having read the book, first of all, A, it's a good read, and B, if this is not grist for somebody who either loves or hates Donald Trump, this is an analytical look at his negotiating style. You'll find successes, you'll find failures, but I think more than anything else, what you will do is find an explanation for how Trump came to negotiate as he does and what we can expect from it. Let's go back into his history and wonder if you could walk us through the nature of some of his business dealings pre-presidency.
Sure. Early on, Donald Trump did some great, well-balanced deals, negotiated very aggressively but very successfully. His first big deal, for instance, in New York City, he redeveloped the Commodore Hotel, which is now the Grand Hyatt, right next to Grand Central Station. And he came in order to get that deal done, he needed help from the government. He needed a tax abatement. And typical Trump, he asked for a super aggressive, unprecedented
tax, no taxes.
99-year tax abatement, which is incredible. Nobody had ever gotten something like that. Now, the government had an important interest, not just their position, an interest in providing a tax abatement because the Commodore Hotel at the time was in an area that it was in that was really run down and it really needed to be redeveloped. And
Manhattan had some real – it wasn't the Manhattan of today.
Late 70s, early 80s, and Donald Trump had the guts and the vision to take on a redevelopment job that not a lot of other developers really wanted to touch. And he did a great deal, and he did his homework, and he focused on the details, and he went through in fine-tooth fashion – a 65-page legal document negotiating all the little I's and T's and making sure everything got done. Really good deal, and he was able to close that deal.
I think you described that as one of the few instances when Donald Trump sort of got down in the weeds on detail.
Well, he got down in the weeds in detail in his early deals. He also did that on Trump Tower, another really successful, really aggressive, but really excellent negotiation from him. He recognized the opportunity. He actually bought the land on Fifth Avenue that no one else even knew was available. He ran down. It was a bankrupt department store, and he quick got his money down and got that deal done. Several days after he got that deal done, just for the land, other developers wanted it, but by then it was too late. He had signed on the dotted line, and he was off to the races.
Now, one of the things I found most interesting was you developed what you called your five golden nuggets of negotiation, and you contrasted that with 10 principles that Donald Trump seemed to his style embodies, and you match these things up. I wonder if you could talk, not necessarily about all of them, but a few of them, what the principle is and what does Trump do in that area?
Sure. In fact, I go through, and in fact, my first book, which you and I have discussed before, my Gain the Edge, I go through really the fundamental research-based proven strategies and tactics that we know work in the negotiation field. I call them the five golden rules of negotiation. First golden rule, information is power. So get it. You have to set your goals. You have to get information. You have to do your homework. And I match that up with the first, what I call four of Donald Trump's top 10 business negotiation strategies. A fundamental element of all my five golden rules is a strategic mindset, a strategic approach. Donald Trump, by contrast, and I'm not saying he hasn't done it well in certain contexts, but the first chapter of my book is labeled Trump's instinctive win-lose mindset. He really does do it off the cuff. He really does do it in a sort of winging it fashion. Not what we recommend in the negotiation field and in part, but that drives a lot of his deals. We also talk in terms of information as power, so get it, setting your goals. What does Donald Trump do? Sets incredibly aggressive goals. That 99-year tax abatement,
We're going to build a wall and Mexico is going to pay for it as an illustration.
Well, I talked about that.
That's ambitious.
Yeah. But actually you put your finger on that issue, which is not only is it ambitious, but it's so incredibly unrealistic. And it set him up in a political presidential negotiation context in a very counterproductive way. Now, in his early business deals, that type of aggressiveness really allowed him to succeed in ways that no one else really believed he could succeed. When he built Trump Tower in the early 1980s, a very competitive real estate market in New York, it became the place for people to live, to shop, and he did it and exceeded the expectations of anyone who looked at what he was able to do up until that point.
Give me another one or two. We got about a minute and a half here.
Great. So my second golden rule, maximize your leverage. Donald Trump knows leverage. He has a really clear understanding of what it means. He knows that the more you need a deal, the weaker your leverage. He knows that the ability to walk away and go with your plan B, that gives you leverage. He has exercised his leverage in a lot of deals, a lot of different contexts. He bluffs. He threatens. He actually engages in what I call business bullying in the book. He knows it. He gets it. He uses it.
Well, that's a little bit of a taste for some of the stuff that's in the book in terms of Donald Trump's early business dealing. When we come back after the break, we're going to talk about, all right, now we're moving into the public arena as president. He's learned some things that have worked for him in business. How well did they translate into the public arena as president of the United States? We will return with Marty Latz in just a moment in the Think Tank.
The Think Tank, KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
We're back with Marty Latz. I call him the negotiator. He has just written another book. This one is an analysis of Donald Trump's negotiating style. And in earlier segments, we have talked about some of the approaches that Donald Trump used in business, in some cases with success. We didn't get into the sort of business failures, and they were about, from your book, they look 50-50-ish to me, sometimes some of that stuff. But I want to didn't work out in, because I guess my big takeaway, he sort of has a singular approach to negotiating. And in some context, the hard-nosed win-lose works. In other cases, it can be counterproductive.
Well, I think that's largely right, Mike. But keep in mind that in the mid-1980s, what drove a lot of his failures was not just that he was using the same approach, but he actually stopped doing one thing that he had done in his earlier deals.
Was that the detail?
He stopped doing his homework. He stopped focusing on the detail. And banks were throwing him money, and he was throwing money at the Trump shuttle. He overpaid by tens of millions of dollars for the Trump shuttle. He overpaid by tens of millions of dollars for the Plaza Hotel. And he really lost sight of what had made him really great early on in his career. He really hasn't ever focused on the details since that time. Well, and that's gotten him into a lot of problems.
I said I'd move entirely public policy, but if you could quickly summarize sort of how he blew the USFL deal.
Well, the USFL deal was a fascinating deal. He bought the United States Football League's New Jersey Generals with two goals in mind early on in his career. And by the way, this was the first time that Donald Trump really generated national exposure, national media. And not surprisingly, he loved it.
He wanted an NFL team.
He wanted an NFL team. And he, in effect, became the face of the USFL by
which was an upstart football league, supposedly to challenge the NFL. They were playing in the spring because it's pretty tough to fight against the NFL in the fall.
Well, they figured there were two different markets, and if they created enough level of success in the spring, they would be able to leverage that into
and then cut a deal with the NFL, and then we can merge, and kind of like happened in basketball, and happened actually long ago in baseball.
Well, that's right. But Donald Trump became the face of the USFL. He had a series of really nasty public battles with other owners in the USFL. But he had no patience. And their strategy, the USFL strategy, was to be patient, to build a following, then to do it Donald Trump didn't have time for that. So he really corralled them, got them to vote to move into the fall.
Which is a big
mistake.
That's a bet the farm move.
Bet the farm move. And in fact, they had a network TV contract to go in the spring, couldn't get that to move to the fall, breached the contract in the spring. Their only shot at getting in with the NFL then was an antitrust lawsuit. So they decided to move to the fall. But their argument in antitrust was that the NFL didn't want them to move to the fall. And so the NFL went and talked to all the networks and said, don't do a deal with the USFL. And that was the antitrust lawsuit. Interestingly enough, they won the antitrust lawsuit. But they got $1 in damages because the jurors, by a one-vote majority, decided that they thought that the USFL was trying to do through law what they couldn't do through the market and through business. Wow. And they felt that Trump and the other USFL lawyers were trying to pull a fast one on him, and they shut him down hard.
That's what you get from a jury when they think that, as they've been instructed, that they won the legal case, but they don't really like it.
Well, that's right. And one really interesting footnote in that USFL negotiation is Donald Trump, early on, before that antitrust lawsuit was filed, sat down with then head of the NFL, Pete Rozelle, secret meeting. There's a dispute as to what happened, and we've got public testimony under oath that says it. But what did Pete Rozelle do after that meeting? Have you heard this before? He wrote a memo to the file and he talked to his colleagues about it. Does that give you images of James Comey?
Yeah.
It happened to Donald Trump.
I want to have a record of what happened, and because I don't trust the story that may come out. The other thing I remember in that story is that you saying that there was evidence that Trump was willing to cut a deal where you let me move my team into the NFL and I'll just cut loose, you know, the rest of the league.
He has a history of stabbing his partners and his allies in the back in business, and that cost him.
Okay, let's move that. That's a good segue into the public sphere. I want to skip over the Mexico wall. We may return to that, but Obamacare and his attempt to repeal it.
In fact, there were three different separate distinct negotiations that took place as it relates to repealing his efforts to repeal and replace Obamacare. There was the first negotiation with the House, which failed. There was the second negotiation with the House, which succeeded. And then finally, there was the third negotiation with the U.S. Senate, where at the end of the day, our own U.S. Senator John McCain gave him the infamous thumbs down. And that, in effect, killed Obamacare's repeal and replace effort, at least legislatively.
I recall something else in the story that basically he went after Murkowski when she voted against him in committee, and then he needed her vote for the final bill,
which is
kind of burned his bridges.
Which is a perfect example of the differences between presidential negotiations and business negotiations, especially where you have one anticipate a future relationship with your counterparts.
Which is almost always the case in politics.
Which is almost always the case in politics with Congress and with our allies in international relations. In fact, I don't think it's any coincidence that John McCain was the one who ultimately deep-sixed that effort because, of course, we know 18 months prior, Donald Trump was ridiculing his war hero status.
There was no love lost there, nor any reason for it.
And I'm not saying that John McCain didn't have substantive reasons to vote against it. But if you're on the fence, it's in the gray area, you're asked to give the benefit of the doubt to a president of your own party. He didn't have that from John McCain.
I do recall he had a serious procedural objection to the fact that they were basically throwing out all of the rules of the Senate in order to ram this through. And I don't know that he's ever explicitly said that that was the reason, but that was certainly in the mix.
That was certainly in the mix, although interestingly enough, they did something very similar on the tax cut legislation later on from a rules perspective. And for whatever reason, it didn't seem to generate the same type of objections from the U.S. senators on that issue.
You also made some points in this discussion that he started out from a premise in dealing with Obamacare of having made some completely untenable kind of, you know, I'm going to healthcare for everybody and it's going to be better and it's going to be cheaper and stuff that wasn't attainable.
And it goes back to, in part, the differences between presidential negotiations and business negotiations. And of course, as you know, Mike, there's a chapter in my book on the differences. They require different strategies. So if Donald Trump was super aggressive in business, asking for a 99-year tax abatement, you know, moving down, and another very good deal he did, the Mar-a-Lago purchase, where it could be helpful for him in politics when you are so aggressive in terms of your campaign promises and you continue to adhere to those specific aggressive goals in legislation, it can be problematic because everybody knows it's not going to happen and all of a sudden you got a problem on your hands.
Okay, moving Mexico and the wall, that negotiation with Nieto, the then president of Mexico.
Boy, again, the aggressiveness of his goal came back to bite him because he said, not only are we going to build the wall, we're going to get Mexico to pay for it. But Mexico had no interest in paying for it. They had no interest in a wall. And in fact, the United States, despite the fact that we are conventionally the most powerful nation in the world, when you look at the size of our military, our economy, you know, on all other conventional notions, but in that particular negotiation, the United States really did not have strong leverage in that context. Mexico didn't want a wall. We wanted a wall. We needed a wall. Donald Trump needed a wall. He needed to get somebody to pay for it. And Mexico had no interest in it either then or obviously subsequently.
And you pointed out in the book, you put this in terms of having your plan B.
Having your plan B.
And Mexico's plan B is nothing happens and they're perfectly – Mexico is perfectly happy with plan B. Donald Trump, plan B is failure.
Plan B is failure. Mm-hmm. And that obviously having weak leverage – now, it doesn't mean that Donald Trump didn't pretend and bluff and try to create the perception that he had strong leverage. But everyone knew that behind the table, Nieto – there's no way he was going to agree to a wall or to pay for it. Now, Donald Trump could have gotten some of that if he had been real smart about the negotiations and he had incorporated and created leverage by combining that wall negotiation with the renegotiation of NAFTA. But he didn't do that. And in fact, it ended up in a very embarrassing non-meeting with President Nieto just a couple of weeks after he was inaugurated.
There was going to be a meeting, and then they were having nice conversations privately, and then Trump had a press conference and made a provocative statement.
And Nieto canceled.
And Nieto had to respond in kind because basically the politics of Mexico, if you capitulate to an American president, your popularity is going in the tank.
Well, not only that, but we've seen that even more recently with Prime Minister Justin Trudeau in Canada after the G7 meeting, because Justin Trudeau, again, in this, you know, in presidential negotiations, you've got at the table negotiations and behind the table negotiations. In business, you're always at the table. But Trump was the decider in chief in his business negotiations. Behind the table, you need to take into account, Mike, what you just said. What are the internal political considerations that President Nieto had with Mexico? What are the internal political considerations that Justin Trudeau had with regard to after the G7 meeting? And in fact, Trudeau, all he said in a press conference was, we're going to stand up to the United States. But President Trump took that personally instead of really understanding that Trudeau had to say that for his domestic political audience.
And got big gain for that. If you appear to roll any, I want to suggest, not just Canada, not just Mexico, anybody, any national leader on the face of the earth that appears to cave to an external power is going to be weakened from that. And in a democracy is going to be less popular for that.
And by not truly understanding that was the political constraints driving some of our allies in these trade and other related negotiations, President Trump actually makes it harder for a Justin Trudeau to make any concessions because now, again, to his domestic political audience, he's going to look weak.
Okay. We've hinted at it. We've talked it on the edge. When we bring you back for the final segment, I want to talk about your analysis of the full range of differences between negotiating in a business context and negotiating in a political context. When we return with Marty Latz in the Think Tank.
The Think Tank, KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
We're back with Marty Latz, the author of The Real Trump Deal, an eye-opening look at how he really negotiates. We've been talking about Trump dealings, his how he learned to negotiate in business, how he has functioned in a political environment. I'd like to move to kind of the analytical point. And that's the thing I would actually stress about this book. This is not a hit piece, nor is it a love fest. This is an analysis of negotiating style and how the style that Donald Trump, I think it's fair to say my takeaway conclusion as a reader is Trump has one style of negotiating that worked for him in some circumstances. It doesn't work in other circumstances. We talked about business. We talked about politics. Lay out for us what you think the biggest set of differences are between negotiating in the public sphere versus in private business.
Well, keep in mind, Mike, that Donald Trump for almost 50 years was negotiating exclusively in business. He really hadn't negotiated in a political or presidential context at all, other than as a businessman. As we talked about before, he was the decider in chief for his family business.
He didn't have to please anybody other than himself.
But when you move into a presidential context, which is different even from regular political negotiations, because now you're president of the United States, now you're dealing with Congress, you're dealing with our allies, you're dealing with our adversaries. And the complexity of the negotiation with so many different moving parts is exponentially greater than a zero-sum buy-sell agreement when you're trying to buy or sell a business or a building in Manhattan.
And multiple people, but as you pointed out also, multiple people that you're going to deal with over and over. In contrast to his business dealings, pretty much all of them one-shot deals.
And even if they weren't one-shot deals, and some of his business dealings were not one-shot deals, but because of his negotiation strategy and style, they became one-shot deals because he really isn't a partnership kind of guy. He did this great deal with Harrah's early in his business career for a casino in Atlantic City. That partnership blew up within the year, led to litigation. Keep in mind, this
Why?
Is – it was because – they didn't trust each other. Mm-hmm. Or more accurately, Harrah's didn't trust Trump. Perfect example that Trump actually trumpets in his book, The Art of the Deal, as opposed to my book, The Real Trump Deal. He took Harrah's board members early on before they had a deal around the construction site. And he was trying to create the perception that this was a very busy construction site. He was well along to building a casino. Well, in fact, a couple days before, he knew he was going to do this tour, so he hired a bunch of construction workers, he rented a bunch of construction equipment, and he told these guys, go make it the busiest-looking construction site in the world. Then he walks these Harrah's board members around to create this perception, or more accurately, the misperception. Interestingly enough, one of the board members looked over to some guy and said, hey, why is that guy filling in the hole that he just dug? And fortunately for Donald Trump, he didn't follow up on it. It was stuff like that, which, by the way, Donald Trump describes as an example of what you should do in negotiations. It was stuff like that that led to deterioration in the relationship with Harrah's, led to the litigation. By the way, Donald Trump has been involved in over 4,000 matters, 4,000 litigation matters in his business career. So that tells you a little bit of something about how he deals with parties and relationships.
That's mind-boggling, 4,000. That's got to be Guinness record stuff.
Look, I tell you, I practiced law before I started into this negotiation world. I litigated cases. I don't know any senior litigators that do this on a full-time basis that have been involved in that many pieces of litigation.
Other themes, I guess I'm getting. You rate him highly in his early years for preparation, but that seems to have gone by the wayside.
It did. It went by the wayside in the mid-1980s. He never really got it back, although in one deal, when he negotiated with the banks to get out of his enormous financial hole, I think he did his homework. Mm-hmm. At the time, 1990, he had $3.2 billion worth of debt. He had personally guaranteed $833.5 million of it. And an independent financial analyst hired by the banks to whom he owed the money said he was worth a minus $295 million. He did his homework there, actually did a pretty good deal. He negotiated a deal with the banks, gave him $450,000 a month as an allowance.
To live on. The banks gave it to live on.
Now,
a man who's $300 million in the hole.
And here's an example of how he understands leverage. Mm-hmm. The banks also gave him a like $60 million line of credit to operate those businesses and to wind him down and to sell all the assets that he had overpaid for in the mid-1980s. He took $10 million out of that account, breached the agreement with the banks to whom he owed all that money, and he gave $10 million of that to his soon-to-be ex-wife at the time, Ivana Trump. Mm-hmm. What did the banks do? Nothing, because Donald Trump knew that they didn't have leverage because he was in fact too big to fail.
If they had gone after him, then these businesses would have folded and they would have gotten 10 cents on the dollar.
He was just like the banks were at the beginning of our recession. He was too big to fail and he knew it.
This is like the old adage, you know, you borrow $100 from the bank owns you. You borrow $100 million from the bank, you own the bank.
Well, that's exactly right. And he understood that, interestingly enough, as a business operator, he really failed on a pretty consistent basis. His licensing deals since then, since he went bankrupt, were significant but pretty straightforward deals, not the complexity involved like we see as president.
Wow. Real quick, in just a minute or two, other themes I saw. He tends not to trust anybody. And
right. The
other biggie sees life as win-win. If I win, you lose.
Well, he sees life exactly win-lose.
Win-lose. It's zero sum. And when you're negotiating price only, that maybe is an accurate view of the world. But in complex negotiations, explains maybe some of the... God, we could have gone for another hour. The book is The Real Trump Deal, available at Amazon, and is...
And you can also get it straight to the Amazon or other sites by going to realtrumpdeal.com.
Well, you will catch all of our podcasts are available at ktar.com. And after a month or two on the KTAR site, I've archived all of them, about 240 of them at this point, at mikeoneal.org. Thank you very much, Marty Latch. You got to come back. I could see talking about negotiations as an aspect of so many things in our lives, and appreciate having you back in the think tank.
Thank you.